Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lana. Are you enjoying springtime in the Northern Hemisphere? I'm a big fan of springtime. This weekend, I'm looking forward to attending an Asatru Austera event, my first one. But right now, Greg Johnson of Countercurrents Publishing joins us. If you don't know about Countercurrents, definitely check out their excellent essays, articles, and book titles covering an array of new right topics. Even their comments section is interesting. Greg is the author of Confessions of a Reluctant Hater and New Right versus Old Right, and his latest, Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country. He's also the editor of many New Right hits. We'll have some fun today talking about the heated subject of gays and women in the nationalist movement and the manosphere. I think Greg has a balanced approach on these issues. One of my favorite things about Greg is his sense of humor, which can at times be cold and harsh. I think it's very valuable when confronting liberal madness. He's never boring, that's for sure. Also, is giving the advice to someone to just be yourself an excuse for complacency when self-improvement is in order? Is just be yourself an argument of a loser? Later, we'll talk about the envy of liberals and why shaming them is necessary. We'll talk about Vantardism and going full Nazi, as some like to say. Much more with Greg Johnson right now. Welcome, Greg. Hello. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on again, Lana. It's great to be back.
So how's Europe this time of year? Here, the terrorism is just lovely.
Yeah, well, I am in Hungary right now, which is a little island of sanity. And so it's very pleasant here. I was in Poland last week, and again, another island of sanity in Europe. You can travel around these countries, and it's like being in Europe, whereas if you go to London or Paris, they don't seem like European capitals anymore.
Oh, that's sad. Well, how are people responding to the Belgian terror attacks in places like Hungary? Are you hearing anything?
Well, I'm seeing soldiers on the street with machine guns at the airports and at train stations and subway stations, things like that. So they have increased their vigilance a good deal, but I'm hoping that the fact that they kept most of these people out is going to be the main security measure that pays off.
Yeah, it's amazing. I watched the news and nowhere, not once, has anyone said, close the borders, deport people. This is where terrorism is coming in. It's really quite simple, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the guy who masterminded one of these attacks came to Budapest and recruited people at the Keleti train station, which is about a 15-minute walk from here. That's where you had all the pictures of these angry refugees. Mm-hmm. Dumping out bottles of water that were given to them by the kindly cucks in Hungary before they got wised up a bit. So, this is where terrorists come from. They come from the Middle East, and if you allow people from the Middle East in, you're allowing more terrorists in.
Yeah, I think that we're only going to see more, and maybe that's going to be a good thing. Maybe there needs to be more to wake people up, or they're just getting used to it. They're just going to that's just the way it is here now.
Well, that is one of the things that worries me, that they will try and just make this the new normal. And I think that people have to revolt against the idea that this is going to be the new normal in Europe. This is not normal. This didn't happen 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It was just not a problem. And Europeans should not accept this as the new normal.
Well, the times I've interacted with you, you always seem so calm and cool. But do you ever have days where you just really get heated up and you just want to rage hearing all this anti-white rhetoric? Or are you just entirely on a different level of coldness at this point?
Well, it takes a lot to get me excited, I have to say. My pulse rate is very, very low. Doctors, when I go and get checked out, they'll take my pulse, and it's like, you have a really slow pulse.
Really?
And they take my temperature, and it's like, you got a really low temperature. And it's like, yeah, it's normal for me. I'm just kind of cold about this kind of stuff. But I think that's good, because when there have been emergencies in my life, I've been really cool-headed about it. So, yeah, I think it's easier for me to be detached about these things than other people, just because of genes. It's no special achievement on my part. You know, it's not through work or meditation or anything. I just have a certain kind of pulse and a certain kind of body temperature, and it takes a lot to get me really agitated. However, I have to admit that earlier today I was watching over and over again this guy in Belgium decking some bespectacled open borders cuck. That was very, very satisfying. I watched it from three different angles, so it was quite good. And, you know, that's what's got to happen eventually. Europeans just simply have to, they're going to have to start fighting. There are no consequences for destroying European countries. These silly leftists, they feel immune to the consequences of the ideas that they advocate. And there have to be consequences for this foolishness. And, you know, if these refugees and terrorists and other people that they're bringing in don't deliver the consequences, our own people will have to deliver consequences as well. And eventually, you know, we will come to a point where we simply have persuaded all the people who can be persuaded, and the rest simply have to be politically defeated. They have to be removed from power. They have to be silenced. They have to be shunned. They have to be disenfranchised. They have to matter not one little bit anymore. That's the only way we're going to win, is if the leftists who are currently driving everything into the ground become as silenced and disenfranchised and marginalized as they have made us right now.
Exactly. Well, Greg, believe it or not, the last time we spoke was back in 2014, and I was listening to that show kind of chuckling to myself because it was a lot of the 101 questions that we all need to do, and it feels like years has gone by since then, and you've been writing on racial matters and white interests for years. So I'm curious, do you kind of view some of the alt-right, pro-white scene as kind of youngins still in their Pampers, or how do you view some of the young kids coming in?
Well, I've been at this since the year 2000, and when I started, I was one of the younger people involved, and now I'm like an old person in the eyes of many people who are coming into this, and that's exciting. Actually, it's exciting that there are lots of young people, friends of mine, who have been doing meetup type groups around the United States, have told me three separate anecdotes about people who they have contacted through some sort of internet thing, through Twitter or whatever. And they say, you want to hang out? And they'll say, well, yeah, I'd love to hang out, but I can't hang out there because I'm only 16 years old. I'm not old enough to go to a bar. And that's really, really encouraging, actually. So we're getting very, very bright people now and very, very young people. And I think that this is a sign that all the work that people have been doing, especially really in the past few years, at building up a kind of youth-oriented subculture is really paying off. So I'm very excited by that.
Well, I really liked your new book. It's called Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country. And I'm looking at the cover right now, and it has a bunch of cute little blonde kids on it, which I like. And I've always been someone that appreciates, you know, the real kind of white diversity. You're the same way, you know, and I think there's a lot of good diversity among white people and the pro-white crowd. And in my view, you know, if you're a white person who loves white people and you want to fight, then great, you know. And that also includes gay people, so my audience knows. And I believe, you know, gay is biological. It happens in the womb. It happens through hormonal processes. I think the science is there. Not every gay person has been sexually abused. And I think that there's a difference between, you know, leftist faggotry and debauchery versus just a gay, you know, but pro-family rightist. And you actually wrote a good piece called Gay Panic on the Alt-Right, which received a lot of comments. It's always a hot topic for some reason. Don't know why. But what inspired you to write Gay Panic on the Alt-Right and get into sexual politics in your book?
Well, for years now, I have been observing the far-right scene, the white nationalist scene, and there has been this tendency. There's an old joke. There's an old joke, and this is actually a joke that Jews tell about how stupid Nazis are. And the joke is like this. There's this old Jew who's sitting on the beach in Brazil, And he looks over and he sees these two old German men, and he realizes it's Hitler and Goebbels. They're on the beach in Brazil. They've escaped. And so he's listening in on what they say. So he gets a little close, what happens is Goebbels says something like this. He says, "And then we will rise up and we will kill all the Jews and electricians." and the old man asks, what do you have against electricians? And Goebbels says to Hitler triumphantly, "See, I told you nobody would care about the Jews," right? I would always hear this stuff, "And then we will rise up and we will destroy the Jews and the non-whites and the homosexuals." And it's like, wait a second here. The homosexual category is not entirely a group of people who are enemies of white people. I would say Jews are, I would say non-whites are, just because of our nature. It's not good to be in a racially mixed society, especially a society that's ruled by a hostile Jewish elite. But even if every single living homosexual were to disappear from a whiteopia tomorrow, there's going to be a new generation of people born, and there are going to be few homosexuals in every generation. That's just the way things seem to work. And I just sort of regarded that as a kind of bizarre and stupid fixation that a lot of people have. It's like, we must get rid of the Jews and the blacks and the homosexuals. It's like, wait, one of these groups doesn't quite fit in the same way. And I've tried to grapple with understanding why there is this sort of obsessive quality about this on the right in America, or the far right. I think a lot of it has to do with Christianity, it strikes me that people who tend to be non-Christian or lukewarm Christians or pagans or whatever seem to be less upset about these sorts of things. So anyway, I wrote articles about this going way back to the beginning of my career as an online writer. I wrote something on Vanguard News Network about this under a pen name. I think it was in 2002 or 2003. So anyway, I occasionally will, if a new sort of wrinkle to this ongoing debate comes up, I'll make a statement. And so I wrote something on under the title "The Gay Panic on the Alt-Right," and basically the argument that I make, and I think it's a valid argument. It's an argument that was first made clear to me by James O'Meara, is that there is a really easy way that any kind of organization that is exclusively or predominantly male can be disrupted today. And that's by the assertion that, well, there's something a little gay about a bunch of guys getting together. And the assumption of that is that, well, the implication of that, the lesson they want to people to draw out of there is that, at the very least, in order to dispel this gay panic, this gay rumor, we've got to have lots of women involved as sort of chaperones, as beards, in effect, right, to dispel the gay rumor. And it's used as a kind of feminist, entryist, blockbusting kind of argument. And of course, Jews love to use this too, because they want to create a division and panic in any organization or any grouping that opposes their interests. But mm-hmm. It turns out that a lot of people on the right try to use this. I gave an example of a rumor started by Matt Parrott and Matt Heimbach. I gave the example of Sinead McCarthy, who basically just seems to use this. Well, it's just an expression of her rage and nuttiness, but I think it's also an expression of her feminism. She really does seem to be a kind of cookie-cutter feminist, and the cookie-cutter feminist argument is basically this. Sex parity is somehow the norm. It's somehow desirable. And so any organization where there's not equal representation of males and females is ipso facto screwy. And therefore, we need women. We need to add women until we get parity. And I look at that argument as really very silly. And I don't oppose having women involved in the movement at all. I do oppose this idea, though, that there's something ipso facto wrong if it turns out that some organizations and groups are predominantly male. I don't think there's any reason to see that as a defect just in and of itself. But that's what the feminist argument assumes and advances, the premise that anything that is predominantly or exclusively male is ipso facto defective and founded on excluding women, violating women's rights, sexism, the He-Man Women Haters Club, and all that kind of nonsense. My attitude about the movement is basically this. We should have a ruthlessly utilitarian attitude about this cause, where it's a project. We want to change the world. And my attitude is that the only argument for adding a person to the mix is if they actually contribute something positive.
Yeah.
And the idea that, oh no, we need people just because they're women, just sort of tosses out that thing. It's the equivalent of arguing for affirmative action.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And it's like, I don't believe in affirmative action. I'm not a feminist. Since when do we allow these arguments to insinuate themselves into our midst? And so anyway, I reject that. Oddly enough, I think that my attitude on this is very liberal in the sense that I don't object to you being a woman or any of the female authors that I publish because they actually add value to this thing. But if there's a woman who shows up on the scene and basically says, hi, you seem to have a very few women in this thing, and here I am, and so why don't you roll out the red carpet and worship me a little? It's like, because here I am, and I'm a woman. I don't fall for that. That's bullshit.
I think only women who are really lacking or failing have to whine about women all the time. You know, if feminism is for weak white women that can't do something on their own, it's like, just be a woman, do what you're going to do, and shut up about it. You know, I get sick and tired of it too. Yeah, you wrote in your book, I'm going to just read a little paragraph you said about this topic. This is war, not ballroom dancing. In my corner of the movement, women who add something to the cause are welcome. I have no time for men or women who add nothing. And men who do nothing but harass or repulse women who do add something need culling. I think that's very well said.
Yeah, I really had to add that. I have become increasingly impatient with manosphere types, misogynists, and just jerks. I mean, get in there and make me a sandwich type online jerks. A lot of these people do nothing but put comments online, and yet they will denigrate women who actually produce real content and say that their very presence indicates feminism. That's not true. My attitude is that if a woman is making real contributions, adding real value to the movement by being an organizer, by being a donor, by being a broadcaster, by being a writer, whatever, if they're actually adding value to the thing, they're entitled to be there because of the value they add. And they're not saying that I need to be here because I'm a woman. They're saying, look at what I can do. And we'd be idiots to turn people who actually add value away. Especially, and we're also idiots, and I realize this sort of in a blinding flash of insight, we're also idiots if we tolerate men who do nothing but repulse people who do add value simply because they're women. And there's more than a few people like that. And so, like I said, they need culling, and when they show up at Countercurrents, I don't approve their comments, and I just permanently block them from commenting further. And, you know, I don't feel that we are so desperate for people now and desperate for commentary and desperate for input that we have to take in every little stray dog of humanity who shows up at our doorstep. A lot of people add nothing, if they add nothing in comments, and if they add nothing in any other way, it's like, I don't need them. So, I think we can be really selective now for the simple reason that we have massive numbers of really good people showing up. The growth in what we're doing recently has been tremendous in both quantity and quality.
Yep.
And that means that the people who've been at this for 10 or 15 or 20 years, they need to up their game because they're going to be overtaken by these young people coming in. And I think that's really a very positive thing.
Yeah. And I know you get attacked a lot for, you know, some of your gay articles and comments about, you know, homosexuals and their place in the movement. I think straight, but not narrow, correct?
Yeah, I formulated that in that recent article, the gay panic on the alt-right. I think that our editorial policy, our political policy, if we are creating organizations and parties and things like that, is to be straight but not narrow. And by that, I mean this. We need to uphold not just racial integrity, meaning that we want to have homogeneous white homelands. That's just part of the thing. What white nationalism is, as I understand it, is biologically sound politics. Part of biologically sound politics is to create homelands for distinct peoples and to prevent miscegenation, prevent invasions of our homelands by different people and so forth. But another part of biologically sound politics is to uphold biologically normal behavior in the sexual realm. And that means that there are certain natural roles for men and women. I think that we should emphasize that it's important for men to step up to natural roles like being protectors and providers. I think that's what we're biologically programmed to do best. And for women to be mothers and nurturers and caregivers and also community builders, women are really good at that kind of stuff. So biologically based sexual differentiation and norms we need to uphold. And we need to uphold the font of all future white generations, which is the heterosexual family. That's the norm. And it should be institutionally recognized and with marriage and so forth. And yet at the same time, if we uphold these norms, we have to recognize that if there are standards, there are going to be people who deviate from the standards. Okay, so the standards are straight, right? The heterosexual couple, the heterosexual family as the norm. But we don't have to be narrow about it because we recognize that every generation there are going to be people who deviate from that. And as long as the norms are upheld, I don't think most people are too threatened by mm-hmm. the fact that people deviate from it. It's in a situation where that what's normal is under siege by people who want to tear down any distinction between what's normal and abnormal. Then people get really, really worried about this and they feel like they have to, clamp down, right? And it's perfectly understandable. There are a couple articles in my book where I talk about the fact that I'm an out and out transphobic. I just think transsexualism is a ghastly, insane phenomenon in America today or in the white world today. The idea that we're going to break down the distinction between biological sexual differentiation and people who basically have surgeries and hormones and pretend to be male or female. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a sign of insanity. I think that the people who want to do this are mentally ill and they admit to it themselves. That's one of the rationales that they use for pushing forward the idea of sex changes being normalized and things like that. They admit that there's a mental illness there. I think the rest of society is going crazy too if we allow this and if we encourage this. And I think the worst people involved in this are the leftists, the liberals, who are trying to normalize this. And I think the most hideous form of normalizing it, and I mean to write something about this someday, very soon, is normalizing it for children.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That is, if that isn't child abuse, I don't know what is, right? And honestly, you know, I look out at the world and I see groups like, you know, animal liberation people, right? Who will risk jail, right? Risk life and limb even, right? To liberate lab rats. Well, frankly, there are human guinea pigs in this world. There are children who are being given hormones to block them from puberty, right? And why is this being done? Well, it's an experiment by these freaks, these psychologists, these ghouls in the psychological and medical professions. They're experimenting to see if by giving this to prepubescent children, they can create even better simulacra of the other sex through sex change operations. It's an experiment. It's a medical experiment. And frankly, I want there to be, there should be a child victim of transsexualism liberation front, right?
Yeah.
That goes out there and liberates these kids.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah. I mean, they should be putting the research into looking into what creates gender dysphoria in the first place and seeing how we can prevent that. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, exactly. There's a fellow who does some sort of hard number research that I am in a Facebook group with. And one of the things that he argued, or one of the things that he revealed to me, is that there are psychological drugs. You know, there are drugs that have been used to treat people with gender dysphoria to make them less likely to want to kill themselves or mutilate themselves. But this isn't being encouraged, right? Mm-hmm. What is being encouraged is transsexualism. What's being encouraged is hormones and surgery. And here's the thing, though. One of the criteria for evaluating whether or not a particular treatment, particular psychiatric or psychological treatment is good or not, is whether it increases or decreases the risk of the patient committing suicide. That sounds like a reasonable criterion for evaluating any kind of treatment. Well, it turns out that has been totally thrown out with transsexuals. Sex change operations increase the chance that the person who does this will kill himself. It should not therefore be treated as a medical treatment, right?
Yeah.
For gender dysphoria. It should be disqualified as a medical treatment. And any other psychiatric treatment that increases the risk of suicide would be disallowed, okay? But political correctness is so advanced in this area that they throw away all criteria of what a good treatment is, and they also throw away any notion of informed consent in doing this to children. And that is one of the most sinister, insane, evil things afoot in our world today. I just can't think of anything more disgusting. Well, I could if I gave it some thought, but it's one of the most triggering things that I know of. So my pulse is getting a little raised.
Oh, it's happening! Wow.
It's
happening.
Yeah, it's happening. Yeah. So anyway, we do need to, I would love to see some kind of activist group out there working for the rights, the freedom, the bodily integrity of children who are basically guinea pigs or ghouls who are experimenting with better ways of making transsexuals, which are just butchered simulacra of the opposite sex of whoever undergoes this surgery.
Now, on the flip side of things, you know, we always hear the word homophobia, and I know you disagree with that too, but do you think there's a level of that that's a natural response in straight people that's coming from a survival response, you know, because, you know, straight sex is... it's not just recreational, but it's procreational. So is that coming from something old? And also, you know, or maybe some of the people that are in the right sphere becoming so anti-gays because they're just looking at the, you know, the fag and ass chaps, right, waving the flag all the time on TV.
Well, yeah, I think that there's got to be some basis for this, biologically speaking. But, you know, if you look at different cultures and at human history, it often doesn't have the kind of intense hysterical charge to it that it does in cultures influenced by the Bible, right? And the reason for that is that not is it that homophobia, to use that term, and I do hate these terms because I think they're inherently dishonest, right? Because yeah. Basically, transphobia is basically an attempt to say that it's irrational to be revolted by transsexuals, and homophobia is an attempt to treat revulsion or discomfort or whatever negative feeling you have for homosexuals as inherently irrational, right, and pathological. It's a pathologizing term, okay, and it's dishonest. That said, there are different degrees and different styles of discomfort, revulsion, rejection of homosexual behavior. And when you combine that, whatever level of natural feeling there is, with teachings that this is not just something that's offensive to you, it's offensive to God, that adds a whole different level to it. The idea of sin adds a whole different charge to it, a whole different dynamic to it. And I think that that's one of the things that's going on here. We live in a culture where there are strong influences of biblical morality. And the trouble with biblical morality and the trouble with any notion of sin, basically, is that it paralyzes the ability to think rationally about ethics, right? Because ethics is not just a question of, okay, what's optimal or suboptimal for human flourishing, which can be understood rationally through looking at what makes us healthy or sick, physically, emotionally, whatever, right? There can be a rational form of ethics based on human biology and human flourishing. But to bring in divine commandments, right, and divine punishments and so forth basically paralyzes people's ability to think rationally about ethics. And that's why I think Christianity and Judaism, and of course not many of our listeners are Jews, right? So let's just cut to the chase and say Christianity and any other kind of divine commandment ethics is an impediment to rational thinking about right and wrong, rational thinking about ethics. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think that we need to think rationally about these things if we're going to have rational policies and a rational movement.
You know, for me, at the end of the day, on the topic of gays, I'm more concerned with the feminization of straight males because, I mean, the future of civilization depends upon masculinity. And so seeing an effeminate straight guy is very disturbing for me on a lot of deep levels. How about you?
Well, yeah, let's bring it back to my book. There's a chapter in there where I deal with the gay marriage controversy, and a couple chapters, actually. But one of the points that I make in the first piece about the gay marriage controversy is that the decline of marriage doesn't have anything to do with gay marriage, right? Heterosexuals have messed up marriage, right? We've got no-fault divorce. We've got very confused people about gender roles and things like that. And because there probably always have been a small number of homosexuals or bisexuals in every society, right, throughout history, we know that the existence of homosexuals isn't an impediment to the reproduction of the species, because they've been with us for a long time and the species is still here, right? Mm-hmm. What's contributing to the dramatic decline of the white race is the fact that heterosexuals aren't reproducing, right? Homosexuals have never reproduced or reproduced all that much, okay? They've always been marginal, in their contributions to later generations, if they contribute anything at all. Okay, so If a society dwindles out and dies, it's because the heterosexuals aren't doing their job, okay? And why aren't heterosexuals doing their jobs? Well, there's a whole range of factors there. But definitely one of the problems is that the heterosexual family, heterosexual marriage has become increasingly fragile. And there are a lot of factors contributing to that. One is that people are just more selfish and careerist. Another is that people are confused about sex roles. Women and men are both confused about sex roles. Another is that it's people go into marriage with unrealistic, selfish, romantic expectations that marriage is simply a way that they're going to satisfy a set of preferences that they're bringing to it, as opposed to what it used to be, which is an institution that's supposed to transform you. So you become a different kind of person with more mature preferences. I mean, that's the way it used to be understood, mm-hmm. right? The ethical weight of the institution has been hollowed out, and it's just a kind of consumer model institution now. And it doesn't surprise you, therefore, if increasing numbers of people are saying, well, gee, this isn't working out the way I thought it was going to, and so I'm going to move on, right?
Yep.
And in the past, people would say, well, you know, the fact that you're not really happy with your marriage may mean that you need to work on yourself a little so you can change to make the institution work rather than constantly breaking the institution because you just can't change your 14-year-old's preferences, which have been fossilized, right? And that you're serving when you're 34 now. You're 34, you got the preferences and the maturity of a 14-year-old, and no institution is going to stand in the way of that anymore. Not marriage, not, you know, the state, not any kind of demands from education, nothing. That's really a sad commentary on the decline of character-building institutions in our society. So to sort of bring this back around, I do think that the masculinization of women, the feminization of men, the hollowing out of the ethical component of marriage, therefore the weakening of the family, birth control, things like that, an ethos of hedonism and selfishness. All of these things are contributing to the collapse of white birth rates. That's definitely true. And so, yeah, I look at the masculinization of women, the feminization of men, of heterosexuals as very alarming because we might not recover from that, right? The fact that the marginal number of homosexuals have existed throughout history has never threatened civilization. And I think it's just it's sort of a ghastly attempt to avoid responsibility and actually avoid dealing with the real problem. When the people who are defending marriage, right, they draw the, you know, marriage has been totally hollowed out and bastardized and destroyed. And finally, these people are standing up and drawing the line at homosexual marriage. It's like, okay, fine, I understand the desire and the idea of homosexual marriage. Generally, it just strikes me as a mockery of a serious institution or what was a serious institution. But stopping gay marriage is not going to be enough. You've got to restore heterosexual marriage. And that's a long, long task. And I just see this kind of cheap demagoguery of the anti-gay marriage people as, well, it is. It's just that. It's cheap demagoguery. I would like to see them standing up and saying, we need to end no-fault divorce, right? We need to criminalize adultery. We need to criminalize alienation of affections. That would actually have far more beneficial consequences on marriage and white reproduction and white family life, right, than simply stopping gay marriage. And yet so much energy has been put into an essentially symbolic thing as opposed to really, really working to strengthen what used to be, you know, the substance of marriage, or bring back the substance of marriage in the heterosexual family. So I deal with that in the sexual politics section of Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country.
Yeah, it's an excellent chapter. You also have another chapter called Does the Manosphere Morally Corrupt Men? And I think that this is a perfect place to talk about that because it adds on to this conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, recently I took up cudgels against Roosh V, and there was a lot of controversy about that. And I have become increasingly impatient with the manosphere. I know it is sort of part of the broader alt-right, and it's not going to disappear just because I express my critiques of it or particular manosphere figures like Roosh. But the main critic, critique I have of the manosphere is this. It is a great place to learn a lot about biological reality. Okay, it's a great place to learn elements of a profound critique of the breakdown of normal family life, normal heterosexual dating and roles and things like that. It's a great place to learn about human psychology, male and female. It's wonderful. However, although it gives us all these elements that we need to restore a healthy sexual order in society, that's what it's not about. What it's about is teaching young men to make the present state of moral and social decay work for them. How does it work? Make it work for them? Well, it teaches them how to get lots of sex, right? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, sex is one of the most powerful reinforcers of behavior. And so it just strikes me as very, very unfortunate, because we really need people to fight social decadence and decay and to work to restore healthy sexual norms and healthy institutions, right?
Yeah.
And teaching people how to ride the tiger, basically teaching people how to make decadence work for them, is not the way to do it. Now, there are defenders of the manosphere, friends of mine, who say, yes, but it does teach you information on how to improve your relationships and your family life. That is true. That's definitely true. But it's not just information. The manosphere is also a community. It's an ethos. And the ethos is not directed towards restoring healthy heterosexual norms and institutions. The ethos is basically about basically self-indulgence and learning how to make decadence work for you. And I think that is a very sad and dangerous thing. And one of the things that really came out of my sort of dust up with Roosh is the realization that there's a significant number of manosphere people who basically, they just want to have sex without any consequences, right? And they want to pursue pleasure without any sense of the greater good. And I just see that as a very, very selfish, hedonistic ethos that's basically indistinguishable from feminism, right? I mean, feminism is just about empowering women to do whatever they want in their sexual lives without any consequences, without
any
repercussions.
I think you said these guys are spreading their dysgenic jerk genes. I really liked that.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely that. I mean, one of the things that is discussed in really the best discussions of this I found have been at Hartiste, and I think he's a genius as a writer and satirist. Emancipated female sexual choice is harmful to women and to men because women are not just attracted to men who have healthy alpha male traits. They're also attracted to false positives. And these false positives include men who display a whole range of dark triad traits, narcissism, Machiavellianism, sociopathy, right? And one of the worst things about the ethos of the manosphere is that it teaches otherwise decent guys that if they imitate the traits of jerks, right, narcissists, sociopaths, Machiavellians, that they'll get a lot of female attention, right? And I think that is directly morally corruptive. And the way I put it is that they're turning themselves into the kinds of men that if they have a sister or a wife or a daughter someday, they would never want to be around any female that they're related to, right? Yep. And that's not a good thing. That's corruption. That's moral corruption and social corruption. And it's profoundly disturbing.
And then on the other end, I notice there's dysfunctional women who view these, you know, pathological behavior of guys as being a dominant male, and then they're actually attracted to it.
Oh yeah, yeah. One of the most disturbing fields of female psychology, if you will, is women who are attracted to criminals, right? Women who write love letters to criminals, who pine for criminals and things like that. Well, what's going on there is they're attracted to certain traits that are false positives for healthy male traits. And how do we avoid this? Well, the best way to avoid this is to look to the past, because in the past, first of all, people weren't just constantly hooking up for one night at a time, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's this very, very unusual and pathological behavior. In the past, when people were making choices about romantic partners, they were thinking about life partners, right? And they just didn't do it on their own. They involved the family. And I don't think arranged marriages per se are a great thing or a bad thing. I think that, however, it's important if you're really making a serious choice, if you're going to get married, for a man, he needs to bring female relatives in on the decision-making process, because women see through other women better than men do. And the reverse is also true. Men will see through other men better than women will do. And so if you are a woman and you think this guy might be the one, have your brother hang out with him for a while.
It's true. My brother always knew. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're a guy and you think she might be the one, have your mom or your sister or your aunt or your grandmother spend a little time, and they will have greater insight into this. It's just rational, right? It's mm-hmm. rational to get as many different perspectives as possible. And it's rational to get a woman's perspective on another woman and a man's perspective on another man. We're not talking about some kind of archaic institution where women have no choice, you know, about their mates or some stupid thing like that, as you know, feminists would want to misrepresent it. We're talking about practices that are ancient and rational, because they expand our knowledge and our insight and make it more likely that we're going to make good decisions. That's what I'm talking about. So I really do think that it's quite important to bring in the perspective of people in your family, right? To get the family involved. And marriage in the past used to be a marriage between families. And it used to be about bringing another person into your family. Mm-hmm. And of course, yeah. The family should welcome them. And if there's a real problem with them fitting into the family, that actually should matter. That really should matter. One of the things that I've been meaning to write for years is a critique of Romeo and Juliet. Because, darn it, I think the Montagues and the Capulets had reasonable objections to that match, right?
Yeah.
And yet we have this this play, which is a marvelous play, is constantly held up as as an argument that love should matter above all other things. And actually, even the play itself doesn't really make that point. So anyway, Romeo and Juliet, excessive romanticism, just reducing the choice of a mate to the individuals involved, the choices of the individuals involved. And then beyond that, not even having choices of mates, just choices of one night hookups and things like that. As you get towards that kind of impoverished scene where individuals are just going out and trying to hook up, of course you're going to have really serious mistakes being made over and over again. Serious mistakes with terrible consequences, right? STDs and
yeah, that's a sign your body's brutality. Telling you shouldn't be doing this if you're getting diseases from it, right?
Yeah. And so, but I see the manosphere ethos as really not trying to come up with an alternative to these horrible decisions that women make, emancipated women make. And let's face it, if there were, I guess there's a female equivalent of the manosphere, that would be encouraging men to make horrible decisions too. And both of these things are bad, right? They're bad. And we want people to make better decisions about whom to marry, whom to date, and the things like that. And rather than create a world where people are just leveraging an extreme form of social decline into highly addictive, highly reinforced form of hedonism for those who actually score over and over again.
Yep. I also really like the chapter called Be Yourself? And you laid out the arguments of Andy Nowicki and Ferdinand Bardamu, I think it is, and you add some commentary yourself, and you question the advice. Is telling a man to be yourself just an excuse for complacency when self-improvement is in order? So do you remember those arguments? It was the argument of a loser, I think.
Yeah, well, first of all, Bardamu is Matt Forney, actually, a Matt Forney under a previous incarnation. So the well-known Matt Forney. And the argument that Andy Nowicki was making that's criticized by Forney was that a lot of the manosphere advice is basically telling men not to be who they are, but instead to pretend to be a different type of person, the type of person that women find attractive, right? And he finds that to be a subtle form of female domination. I actually make that point in my article, Does the Manosphere Morally Corrupt Men? In a way, it seems like it's a form of male emancipation, but when it turns out that all these males are learning how to basically appeal to the emancipated female desire, sort of feral female desire, really it's a way that they're molding themselves to fit in with certain things that women want. And unfortunately, a lot of those things are false positives in the attraction realm. Again, attraction to dark triad traits. And Nowicki makes a good point. Bardamu comes out and says, no, there is no self, right? There's no being yourself.
Doesn't exist, right?
Doesn't exist, which is a metaphysically false assumption. But he does make a good point, though. A lot of time, the be yourself argument basically is just an argument for acquiescing at whatever level of immaturity you happen to be at, right? Because, and what I do is I bring in Aristotle and I say, look, there are two selves here, okay? There's who you are at the present moment, and then there's who you are in yourself, who you are in your potential, who you are at your best, right? Your potentiality for excellence. And really, the happy life, the self-actualized life, is about becoming yourself, actualizing your capacities for excellence, all right? And when you say be yourself, right, that's the good sense of be yourself. Be who you are at your best, okay? That's a good thing. And Nowicki's saying, you know, the manosphere isn't teaching men to be who they are at their best, right? It's teaching them to behave in certain ways that fake certain traits that will get them the attention of women who are emancipated and making bad decisions about men. That's what it's teaching them to be. That's not the best. It's their worst. And I think, therefore, it's corruptive. Bartomeu's argument, though, is that you shouldn't be yourself if yourself means the couch potato you happen to be today, right? Yourself not at your best. And I think that there's some truth to that. And both positions are correct. But there is a sense in which be yourself is valid, namely be the best person you can be. And there's a sense in which be yourself can be simply a counsel of complacency when it means just love yourself as you are, no matter how fat you are, how out of shape you are, how dysfunctional you are, how socially awkward you are, whatever, right? Of course, a lot of the pathologies of society today are that be yourself in the bad sense, fat acceptance.
It's very lazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrible. It's a counsel of laziness and self-indulgence. I have to say, we've met, I'm tall and thin. So, I don't have to fight against fat. But honestly, I just hate fat acceptance. Okay. And I look at this kind of stuff. It's grotesque.
Of course
the kind
it is.
Of
yeah.
stuff that people put out there. Oh, you're big and beautiful just the way. No, you're not. You're grotesque. You're unhealthy.
Unhealthy, and it's a drain on the shared medical system, right?
Yeah. I think that, fat shaming is one of the best things you can do to people, actually. I have a strong prejudice against fat people because they're unappealing, they're unaesthetic, and there's a strong presumption, usually accurate, that they are not just unfortunate people. It's not their fault. It's their genes. There's a strong, reasonable assumption that these people have vices, that they are self-indulgent and lazy, right? These aren't good traits, right? You shouldn't accept that. You shouldn't accept self-indulgence and laziness. And what's even worse, though, are the people who try and go out there and basically tear down the norms or invert the norms of society, healthy norms. A healthy body looks a certain way. And we know this to be true. It's just a fact. It's a fact and a norm. Okay. And these women were posting, pictures on Instagram, and it's usually women who are working for fat acceptance, yeah. not men. These obese women with their tattoos and their lingerie trying to argue that they're beautiful. They're not. And to argue that they're beautiful, they have to tear down real standards of beauty. Right? They have to tear down real standards of health. And of course, people react badly to this. Now, again, I think that we should uphold healthy norms, right? We should uphold healthy norms, physical norms, psychological norms, sexual norms, and so forth. And if you can uphold those norms and they're not under threat, then people have no problem accepting that people fall short of that, right? There are going to be people who are skinnier than average and heavier than average, right? And you can accept that. That's just the way the bell curve, rolls, right, or unfolds. That's just how things distribute themselves. But people get naturally very, very upset and defensive when people say, no, we need to change norms. We need to deny that thin is more healthy than fat.
Good luck with that. Yeah, I think all this shaming also comes from a evolutionary need, for our species to have the fittest surviving. And these are weak people that are dragging us down that will ultimately lead to our demise. So we should be shaming them into place.
Well, yeah, exactly. We should be shaming people who are immoral to be moral, who are unhealthy to be healthy. We're doing them a favor. And one of the things that came out of my dust up with the manosphere is realizing there are significant numbers of manosphere types who basically are in revolt against any notion of shame whatsoever, right? There's this one jerk who goes by the moniker Laguna Beach Fogey, We had a little, that's one of his monikers. I remember him way back when, where he was under a different name, and he was revealed as some kind of race mixer. You know, he's a Manosphereian, and we had a dust up on Twitter until I blocked him. And he was saying things, "You sound like a hysterical woman," right? And I said, "You know, next thing you're going to say, I sound like Hitler." Right. Mm-hmm. And the thing he was saying is that there's something horrible about having standards. Right. If you have standards of behavior, you're like a hysterical woman. Right. You're shaming people. Damn right. I'm shaming people. Right. There's a legitimate place for shame. Right. When people behave in shameful ways, they need to be shamed so they behave better. And men should be shamed to behave better, and women should be shamed to behave better. All of us should be ashamed of our bad behavior and try and do better. Okay? That's the simple fact of the matter.
And do you notice how liberals are trying to shame people like us that are striving for excellence, or we're upholding, you know, beauty standards, or we're wanting people to become better people that they can, as good as they can be, and then that's being looked down upon now.
Right, right. Because some people will feel bad about themselves. Yeah. And it's like, yes, exactly. Feeling bad about yourself is one of nature's best spurs to improvement. There's just no question about it. And yet these people, they seem to want to feel no shame or no guilt for anything. Well, that's basically being a kind of sociopath or a psychopath, right? The only people who feel no shame are people who have no standards whatsoever, or whose only standard is to be himself right now at any moment, right? There's no gap between what you aspire to be and what you are, right? If you're drunk and you fall down in the gutter and you're laying there in amongst the dog shit and cigarette butts, and you can tell yourself, "This is the best, you know. This I accept this totally." well, you're welcome to that, but you're a total nihilist and you're a disgrace to humanity. You know, and I'll spit on you if I walk by if I see that. And you should feel ashamed of yourself, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people who will actually argue that it is wicked to make anybody feel bad about anything. Well, bullshit. The only way that people actually become good is to feel bad about being bad.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, and yeah, maybe some people can't help it. You know, some people are crippled, right? Okay, fine. I'm not going to shame a person who can't walk for not walking, right? But I will get in their face if they want to argue that they're just as good as the rest of us. Right. And that there's no such thing as handicaps, and they're just differently abled rather than disabled. That's bullshit. That's a lie. That's a lie. And pretty much everything rotten in our society today is basically people who fall short of the norm, who deviate, trying to tear down the norms of society so they can feel good about themselves all the time.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
It's disgusting, and they should be ashamed of themselves. Everyone has a right to some self-worth, right? But if you're crippled, right, if you're in a wheelchair, if you can't walk, I'm sorry. You know, you want to feel really good about yourself, but you can't, right? You're lacking something. And I'm not going to be mean to you. Again, I won't be mean to anybody who suffers from real misfortunes, as long as they are not trying to tear down the standards that base and tell us lies that they don't suffer from misfortunes, right?
Yeah, we have to be realistic about our limitations, right?
Yeah, yeah, and again, this goes back to all these questions, like the gay question or transsexuals or any other group. There are people who are going to fall short of the norm. There are women who might be really masculine and not cut out for having kids. I'm not going to say that you are a bad person if that's really authentically who you are. I'll say you're I would say it's a misfortune, right? I would say that's your misfortune. I think that you should deal with it with dignity, and if you deal with your misfortunes with dignity, no sensible, decent person should be putting you down. But if you are in revolt against standards and trying to say, wait, I'm not misfortunate, I'm not abnormal, you're evil for having norms, then the picture changes. And this is why I think there's such a backlash amongst sensible people against things like gay liberation, transsexuals, gay marriage, and so forth, because they sense that it's not just an argument for tolerance that's being advanced. It's a moral revolution. It's the inversion of norms or the destruction of norms, just in order for botched people or unhappy people to feel better about themselves. And we can't allow that. That is something that has to be fought tooth and nail. And I totally agree with that. Tolerance, I think, is perfectly consistent with upholding norms, right? It's simply the recognition that, okay, yeah, there's the normal, there's the ideal, and then there's the bell curve, and there are going to be some people on either end of the bell curve who don't fit. And we need to make some allowances for that. That's fine. It's when these people start claiming that they're superior, right, or that the norms need to be overthrown, that I think it's reasonable for there to be a backlash.
It's happening right now.
Yeah, it's happening. And again, so back to the thing where I say, we should be straight but not narrow. We should be, that's simply a recognition that norms, that traits are distributed on bell curves. You can uphold norms and recognize that there are people who fall short of it on either end of the bell curve. And that's just the way the cookie crumbles. But, one of the books that was most influential on my thinking is Nietzsche's On the Genealogy of Morals. And in there, basically, what he does is he talks about Christianity. He talks about Christian ethics. And he argues that Christian ethics, the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount, where, blessed are the meek, right? Blessed are the people who are ill-favored according to the healthy standards of the time. These norms are driven by resentment, he says. The resentment of people who are ill-favored by nature against those who are better favored. And therefore, what they're trying to do is they're trying to invert morality. They're trying to invert norms. And so instead of pride, which is a virtue and a trait of and a birthright of any healthy organism, right, to take joy in your good fortune, right? Pride is a sin now, but meekness and humility are virtues. That is what Nietzsche called the slave rebellion in morals. And basically, pretty much every sick campaign of the left is just carrying forward that slave rebellion in morals, right? Tearing down healthy norms to make botched people and unfortunate people feel good about themselves.
It sure is, and it's full of envy at the end of the day, right? It's a lot of ugly women who are trying to say that this beauty ideal isn't really beautiful. It's just what you've been programmed to believe, right?
Right, right. And we know, based on nature, that certain things are beautiful and ugly. I mean, it's objective. It's objective. Beauty is not just in the eye of the beholder. There are objective elements to beauty, and you can't change that. You can only lie about it and force other people to go along with your lies. And that's really what's bad about political correctness. Political correctness is a form of lying, right? It's a form of lying. I talk about this in Truth, Justice, and A Nice White Country. It's a form of lying. In the racial field, political correctness constantly takes the form of injustice, where you basically blame people who did nothing wrong for the failings of others. Right. So whites who have done nothing wrong are at root, at the root of, they're to blame for the fact that blacks don't perform as well as whites in white societies, right? And black crime and pathologies, those are exculpated, right? All that guilt is basically taken away from these people and put on white people. It's just a form of lying and injustice. And that's why I talk about truth, justice, and a nice white country, because our enemies are all about lies and injustice. Political correctness is lying and injustice.
Sure is. Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about was a chapter you have called Vanguardism, Vantardism, and Mainstreaming. So tell us about Vantardism.
Well, this came out of a discussion that Colin Liddell and Ramsey Paul and Andrew Anglin were in. And basically, what I tried to do is I tried to come up with a nuanced position on this issue. Andrew Anglin, who runs the Daily Stormer, is sort of full Nazi, right? And Colin Liddell and Ramsey Paul think that is not a good strategy. It's just basically it's taking on a needless burden and linking white advocacy with National Socialism and the Holocaust and Holocaust revisionism and all that other stuff. It's just a needless burden. And generally, the people who are sort of full Nazi claim that they're vanguardists, meaning that, you know, we need to stand up for the truth, right? No matter how unpopular it is, and we need to persuade everybody to come around to our position. And then there are people like Ramsey Paul and Colin Liddell who are considered mainstreamers. It's like, no, we can't marginalize ourselves. We have to mainstream our ideas and bring our people around to our way of thinking. And that means we've got to meet them halfway, right? And my position on this matter is somewhat nuanced. I argue that actually vanguardism is correct. It's definitely correct. But the full Nazi vanguardists aren't vanguardists at all. They're vantards, as I put it, or vantardists. Because they pretend like they're the vanguard, but they're really doing things that actually retard our cause. They retard our cause by essentially asserting that the only authentic way of advocating for white interests is to go full Nazi. And I just think that's dumb. That's totally dumb, because there are a lot of different ways of coming to arguing for white interests that don't have to go through what happened in Germany between the First and the Second World Wars. If what we believe is based on nature and history, on reality in the broadest sense, then our kinds of ideas are true and valid for every kind of people, in every society, in every stage of history. And that means that we don't need to run everything through the circuit, the narrow little circuit of National Socialism. Now, if that's where you come from and it's sincere and it's an expression of who you are, fine. I don't advocate people being phony, right? And I spent a lot of time very, very enthusiastically reading up on all the old right thinkers, like, you know, the National Socialism and fascism, and I learned a lot, it's inspiring, et cetera, but I recognize that that's not the only authentic way that you can be a white advocate. Mm-hmm. And I think the vantards are false in asserting that, and I think the mainstreamers are correct in what they're saying, that there's something self-defeating and perverse about this mentality. That said, I'm not a mainstreamer, because I do think that a genuinely vanguardist position is necessary. And I just come up with a different list of what I think is essential. Okay. And so I talk about, well, I'll just run through the list of what I think are the sort of non-negotiable essential positions that we have to defend and that I defend. There are four political absolutes, and this is on pages 205 to 206 of my book. There are four political absolutes. First of all, is that white people are a race. We constitute a distinct race. That there is a racial dimension of white identity. That doesn't mean that we're simply white people in a generic sense. There are linguistic and historical and other elements of different white identities. But I will say that you can't be a Frenchman without being a white man, right? There's more to being a Frenchman than being a white man, but you can't be a Frenchman without being white, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of confusion about white identity. There are some people who want to argue that what we are is Christendom, but that's not true because there are Black Christians and Asian Christians and so forth. So we have to recognize that there is a racial component to who we are. White people, European peoples are all white, right? Second, the second essential point is that whites are threatened with simple biological extinction, right? That is the most pressing threat that we face. We will cease to exist. And I have a couple chapters at the beginning of the book on this. One is called White Extinction and the other is called White Genocide. Whites are facing biological extinction in every country where we exist. And that means that our race will cease to exist unless we interrupt and change the present trends. And the third sort of non-negotiable vanguardist truth that we have to bring our people around to is that the only solution for white extinction and white genocide, because I do believe that white extinction is not just some kind of ghastly, unintended cosmic mistake, but it is a policy, right? An intentional policy. The only solution to that is for whites to gain control of our political destinies and create homogeneously white homelands, white nationalism, okay? And then the fourth point that I think is non-negotiable is that Jews aren't us. Jews are not Europeans, okay? They are their own group with their own sense of identity, their own destiny, and they define their interests in contradistinction to ours. They're our enemies, okay? And we need to wake up to that fact because just because we want to pretend that they're our friends or that they're neutral, it doesn't make it so. And they are the principal impediment. The organized Jewish community is the principal impediment to us gaining control of our destiny and stopping white genocide, stopping white extinction. Now, I think that those are four controversial, unpopular opinions. Boy, they're controversial and unpopular if you take it to your average libtard or Fox News viewer, right? But those are things that we have to bring people around on and that we cannot compromise on. Now, I am 100% pragmatic about ways that we can bring people around on these issues, but we can't compromise on these points, right? Anything less than all four points that I laid out is not going to be sufficient to save us. Okay. And therefore, we have to be principled vanguardists and we have to lead the way and we have to bring everybody around to our way of thinking. But we can be totally pragmatic in the ways that we do it. We can try and reach out to every white constituency, every white identity group, every white nation, every white interest group, every white hobby group, you know. We can use every possible medium. From songs and, I don't know, some people might want to do it with dance, right? Or mime. Somebody's going to has to get out there and mime white nationalism. No, but in all seriousness, we need to use the written word. We need to use the spoken word. Podcasting, it's one of our great gifts, one of our great tools. Movies and television, however we can get the word out, we need to get it out there in every possible means. That's sort of the truth in mainstreaming. We do need to make this mainstream. A deeper truth is that we need to make the mainstream come around to our way of thinking. And to do that, though, we can't compromise our way of thinking, right? We can meet them halfway in every inessential issue and utilize every technical means available, but we can't compromise on the truth. And so I'm a vanguardist, unapologetically so. I'm not a vantard, right? I think the vantards, you know, some of them are appealingly principled people. And I would say that sometimes you build up strength by carrying around unnecessary burdens. I mean, that's sort of what weightlifting is, right? But they're wrong in asserting that the only authentic form of white advocacy is being full Nazi.
The book is Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country, which I thought was a very fun, easy read. I think it's a good one to give friends and family. So tell everyone where they can buy the book.
You can buy it at Amazon.com or you can buy it at countercurrents.com. That's www.counter-currents.com. If you order it from Countercurrents and you stick it in your PayPal transaction, a little note to me, I'll sign it for you when I send it out. The next batch will go out after the 6th of April because I'm traveling right now. But as soon as I get back, if you've put in an order and you want me to sign it, I'll sign it for you. So anyway, I urge you to buy it. I'm very proud of this. It's a collection of essays that I've written over the past few years. There's an introduction and 38 other essays in there. You can read it for free online, but it looks really good on paper, and it has a different kind of impact, I think, on paper.
Yeah, I like books, good old-fashioned books.
You know, and the ebook thing has peaked. People like good old-fashioned books. It's a really handsomely done book. Kevin Slaughter did the design work. He does most of our books for Countercurrents. And I urge you to pick it up. There are a lot of people out there who are getting free information on the internet, and we put it out there for you. There's a much smaller number of people who actually pay for this stuff, but we have to have people who pay so we can keep the lights on and keep the material going out for all the people who want to get it for free. So don't just be a free rider. Pick up the book and support Red Ice Radio, support Countercurrents, support Occidental Observer, whatever platform or outlet you find appealing. But don't just be a free rider. Also, you know, pay your way.
That's right. We need to expand. This is a war. We need more media. We need more publishers. We need more broadcasters. And unfortunately, you need money to do that. So we do appreciate all the support. Greg, thank you so much. It's always a blast having you on and talking with you. So thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a great time. I really have enjoyed it.
Gays and women. I don't really think of these too much since I just do what I do and like who I like. I'm not a politician. I'm a commentator. You encounter good and bad gays and good and bad women, same as everyone else. Just because you are gay or a woman does not exclude you from criticism either. And just because you are a woman, you shouldn't get automatically catapulted to the forefront. Everyone must earn their respect and their place, no matter who they are or what genitals they have. Do I think the pro-white movement is threatened because a few gays are a part of it? Absolutely not. This is laughable and weak, especially when the few gays who are a part of this scene are supporters of white survival. Like I said, some people are born gay. It's not their fault. And if that bothers you deeply, and if you think our race will be threatened because of it, become a biologist and discover how to prevent or alter that. Yeah, as a straight person, it's kind of creepy thinking of two guys or two girls getting it on. But you know what? I just don't let myself think about it. Just like I don't want to think about my straight friends doing it. Sex should be private. Does that mean I support all flamboyant, reckless gay behavior and faggotry or child molesters? Of course not. Same goes for women. I do not support all actions and behavior of modern women simply because they are women. Do I think we need female voices in the pro-white scene for it to go somewhere? No, it's already gone somewhere. If there's a need, it will arise organically and naturally and not be contrived or forced. And over the years, I've seen plenty of women come on board either independently or because of their male counterpart. Let it happen organically. If women will come, they will come of their own will. And if a woman is scared off by one Daily Stormer post, then how committed is she to her race? We don't need flighty women with a temporary interest. Usually, though, the majority of women come when there's already something built and when the men who built it attract them. Most women aren't politicians, public speakers are outspoken on controversial topics. That's just the reality of it. And so what? Let nature do its course. Let women make their choice. Let it happen organically. Women are here and more are coming. This is going to be a long weeding out process for all our people. And if we want the best of them, we must be patient. Regarding children, I acknowledge that a family unit with a man and a woman is best for children. I also know children are highly important, and I've met some female nationalists who have not met the right man and their window has sadly closed. I've also met the occasional female who doesn't feel the urge for motherhood, and I've met some women who say one kid is enough. I also accept all female nationalists no matter what their marriage or motherhood status is. There will be those few that don't fit in entirely. Like Greg said, straight but not narrow. Bottom line, accept those who are sincere but fall on the outside of the norm. There must be compassion for our own who have unique circumstances. Not everyone will fit into one neat little nationalist box, and that's okay. Every tribe needs different roles to fulfill. Diversity among our own can be extremely useful. I know there's a lot more to say, and I'm sure it will come to me after I release this. Please visit redicemembers.com and sign up for a Red Ice membership to help support what we do. Or if you listen to this show, which is always free, consider sending a donation. Soon we'll be launching our new website and mobile website, and it's about time. Lots more to come. Talk soon.